future it holds for us all.
And that's just
KF2ZZ.
Yes, Leslie.
Okay, I did forget about it, but this is very much interesting. How quickly science is expanding into the practical use that we have right now. The entire rocket to be printed, and it was printed, it was shown, this rocket. And it looks amazing. That competition is actually healthy. Think that is going on, because then we do not have some crazy billionaires, almost trillionaires, who are trying to impact our being on the planet Earth because they have money. And of course, the cost and the expense of United States on NASA for on those technologies is going to be smaller, because the more competition you have, the better it is. That's the whole idea about the progress. So, yes, they show, let me drop it. Okay, they show entire process of printing. They didn't hide it. So it was laser printing on metal. We know that there was a technology known as sintering, and that was a technology that is not new. It was used in making ferrites, or even your handles in your locks, or many elements, and that allows small things to be made very cheaply. So the technology of the ferrites was that you took the iron powder and put it into a ceramic jar and poured the water in it. It rusted, and then you had particles that you put along with the binder and press it, and then you had the ferrite that you use in your ham radio. So then people decided that they want to do 3D printing for other things. And the bonding wasn't good. There was so much of a space between each one of the powder particles, and it wasn't very rigid. It was very much not immune to cracks. But now we have a laser welding, and we have a very solid structure that is created for the use of, let's say, rockets. And I do thank you very much, Paul, for reminding that. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okay, very good. Brian, did you want to say something?
Well, I wanted to go ahead and check to see if everyone came back, so I guess you did, so I'm glad. When is the SpaceNet report?
Well, theoretically, in 10 minutes, unless no one has any questions or comments past this time.
Like me, if you're talking about metal with 3D printing, I wonder if you have these giant machines that are, like, so large to print, I would hope that nothing actually breaks so easily when it's done, because you look at the very smaller ones that we use with our computers, like to print out figures and whatnot, because one time I had my brother make a Pikachu for me. I haven't even gotten around to painting it. I felt like it would break if I were to drop it. I wonder what materials would be able to handle such very large 3D printing. KD2 OGB Mobile.
Hello, Craig. Long time no here. Well, as far as I'm aware, most of the stuff that the space, the rockets tend to use, tend to be some form of 3D modeling for metals, which are different things than the stuff that I use, which are pretty much all plastic based. You know, plastics can, you know, there are flexible plastics, there are sturdy plastics, there are plastics that are somewhat resistant to ultraviolet and all kinds of different melting points. Metal is much more durable usually, but much more expensive. Both the 3D modeling technology requires a much more expensive mechanism, and the ingredients that are used tend to be orders of magnitude more expensive than the plastic filaments that I use on my 3D printers. So, yeah, they tend to be sturdy. One of the things that they almost always do is, you know, after they're created, the first few prototypes are kind of banged around a lot to see how tough they are.
Yeah, my brother was educating me on it when he was still in the house. Speaking of which, actually, with UV, he was even telling me all the hazards when it comes to, like, when you're filling in the stuff, like when you're using, like when you're adding in more material to be used for 3D printing, and when you take the cover off, you need gloves, you need a respirator, which I feel like that's a little too much for protection. I mean, you could really use a dust mask, but I think these fumes are, like, very, very poisonous if you don't use a respirator.
Well, I don't know how dangerous. It's sort of, number one, you're not talking about filament-based 3D printing, which is what I do. Those are solid, meltable plastic filaments on a roll. They run through the roll into a heating system where they're melted, and then they're kind of glooped on to the base. And the print head moves 300, you know, in X, Y, and Z direction and builds upon it. Those are relatively safe. You need a door, a window open someplace just to air out the plastic fumes, but they're not inherently dangerous. You're talking about resin, which is ultraviolet cured resin. It's a gloopy liquid that's submerged in a tank with an LCD, like an iPad screen at the bottom, with a UV source below it, and it keeps on exposing different layers to UV, which cures it into a 3D form, and it slowly rises out of the tank, and you break apart the supports, clean it up a little bit, and then you have to put it in a environment with a lot of ultraviolet, so the little bits of resin that didn't solidify will solidify, and then you do the final clean off, and it's a slightly different variation on a theme. It's not quite as dangerous as you make it kind of sound where you got to put it on a respirator and stuff, but you got to watch it. The fumes and such cannot be terribly helpful for your respiratory status. But, I mean, the plastic filaments are relatively safe. They don't have that problem.
Yeah, that's what my brother was trying to tell me. It seems very complicated on all those structures that you got to go through as, like, the design raises up and then the plates raise up and you got to do this and that. Seems like a bit of a mouthful. Because I was thinking maybe the most poisonous substance that you could ever deal with is lead, but I don't think that's used in 3D printing unless a very, very small amount of it is used. And even so, lead is very heavily regulated these days because of how dangerous that is.
Yeah, lead isn't part of 3D printing, except maybe in some cases with solder. European solder is lead-free, but there are still people in places, and it's a lot easier to solder using lead than the lead-free EU type of solder. So you don't have to particularly worry about lead being a factor. Like I said, as far as the filament, the melting filament is concerned, you're using different forms of common plastic, you know, the plastic that your bottles and such are made out of, the same PLA that a lot of people tend to use for filament run 3D printing. So there's not that many dangerous chemicals with filament, whereas with the other, the solvent-based UV type of stuff, there are safer mixtures than others. So that still has yet to be settled out. It's a little bit more problematic than filament-based 3D printers.
I was just thinking, actually, if lead was still used in soldering. I got to ask SQHB about that next time I see him, because I know he's got quite a bit of experience with soldering, and he even showed me a little bit, but I need to learn the ropes of that. Yeah, it's good to know. Anyway, I'm pulling down my block, so I think it's time I say 7-3s to this next. And I've been floating around, Roy, but I've unfortunately been, like, quiet and dead silent all this time. I mean, I listen quietly, but I don't even throw my call out there unless I'm trying to directly call somebody. But, yeah, I have been dark for, like, a long while. But I still pay my dues, and I still, on occasion, will come to the meetings. I went to, this past month, actually, one. So, I'm still floating around. So, I'll let you take the rest of it. AC2GS, net control, KD2OGB Mobile.
Okay, very good, Craig. I'm glad to hear you're well, even though you're not regular anymore. And if you ever need us, you know where to find us here.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night, Craig. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. We got a couple more minutes. If anyone needs one, if they have a question or a comment or a topic, or they want to respond to something that they heard tonight, feel free, hit that push to talk.
I heard reports that there's going to be a rocket that's going to be filled with black beans as the fuel source. It's owned by Taco Bell.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brian. Appreciate it. Appreciate everyone tonight. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you were entertained. I hope you were amused. I hope you join us next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. So it's precipitously close to 10:15, less than a minute by my reckoning. So we might as well just kind of move on. And again, thanks everyone. I'll be back at the end of this to say a proper goodbye for the week. And let's hope the repeater continues to behave and stops doing that strange thing that it did earlier. Anyway. It's certainly a good time as any for a full WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy. Very good. One of the metals is Inconel, I-N-C-O-N-E-L. They use that for high strain purposes, so you'll make a whole combustion chamber out of that stuff. And they can 3D print that, which they do. But they still have to be careful when they 3D print it, because they just tested a rocket engine recently, I forget which engine it was, what company. And they put in a test man, and what happened was, it makes layer after layer, and halfway up as it was going along, it wound up with imperfections. Probably porosity or whatever it is. Anyway, it was a slight imperfection in one of the layers. So when they tested it on the test stand, it blew the whole thing apart. So they do have to be careful with that. But Inconel is, they call it 718. I remember they made out of this. They used to weld that together and extremely used for extreme high stress. Anyway, let me just drop it before we start the net. Yeah, because that has to do with Wes's topic, with the engines and the 3D and all that. But yeah, they're really, the engines themselves, are many companies that use 3D capabilities for that as well. By the way, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And if you look at the nozzles on all these rockets nowadays,
in fact, the old days too, which, you know, there's a nozzle, but there's actually in a nozzle, so you don't have an outer and an inner section. The reason for that is they send cold, most of the time it's cold liquid hydrogen through that. The idea is to keep the nozzle as cool as possible because the temperatures are really soaring when they come out of the combustion chamber. And by having that, you know, heat exchanger capability, they're able to, you know, save the nozzles. They won't burn up when they're going uphill. In the old days, with you know, when they used to do this, like, you know, even the space shuttle, they would have two different layers like that, but they would have thousands of like braids or, you know, connections inside to try to keep these two structures together. But now it's all 3D print. But, you know, you're able to do that without, you know, worrying about thousands of little tiny joints that had to be, you know, made sure it was secured. So it's one of the biggest advantages of doing it with 3D. They can make complicated designs instead of, you know, many different molds and then trying to weld all the molds together. You know, it comes out in like, you know, one piece, virtually piece. And the one that Wes had was, you know, they did show the video. It was a three-year-old video, but it showed building the whole rocket from the top, you know, from the bottom all the way to the top. And that was just, you know, that's for the, you know, the smaller rocket. So that worked out great, went to orbit. But they scratched the Tehran 1 rocket, and now they're building the Tehran R rocket. They're going to try to make as many components as they can with 3D, but it turns out like it's the other way around now. 80% of the rocket is not going to be made with 3D. It's not cost effective, you know. Anyway, let me just put down a couple of items here, unless somebody has comments, you know, early on in the space portion part of the net, WS2N.
KF2CC with a comment.
Oh, Brian, very good. I like your joke.
Thanks. I'm just curious about the, I'm very concerned, actually, about the Starship from Musk. It's been blowing up every time it's been launched. Any future to it?
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was definitely on my list for tonight, but since you asked, we might as well do it now. Starship launched on Tuesday, last week. Launched 7:30, exactly 7:30 Eastern Standard 30 Texas time, where they launched from. The booster, and by the way, this was called number 9, the ninth try, the ninth launch. And the booster was, you know, you have the booster and then you have the Starship on top. So the booster was a reusable booster that they got from number 7. Remember, they had the capability of catching things when they came back. They've done it a couple of times. Well, when number 7 came back, the booster anyway came back, you know, came back whole, and they were able to use that on this launch. By the way, the launch of number 7, the Starship itself was one of the times that it blew up over the Turks and Caicos Islands. But the booster was okay, so on flight last Tuesday, the booster was successfully launched. All 33 engines lit. It lifted off, and it looked good in the beginning. But then it started, you know, as the time progressed, the Starship separates from the booster, and the booster plant come back and be caught. They wanted to do some tests to see, you know, how good the booster could perform by, you know, flipping over and doing a couple of different things that it wouldn't normally do. But anyway, it finally came down through the atmosphere, and they planned on coming down near Texas, in the Gulf of Mexico. And as it was coming down, the engine was supposed to light up time before it got down near the water. And, you know, it was going to come down vertically, you know, trying to duplicate a vertical landing. But that thing blew up before. So that was a failure. So that was not a good sign. Now, the ship looked like it was on its way to its planned location, which would have been the Indian Ocean. But the ship looked like it was doing okay. They had some tests that they planned on doing. So what they had is a bunch of mock Starlink satellites inside. They're not real satellites, but, you know, duplicates of what they looked like. They had 8 of them inside. And the idea was to open up this door, and they were going to deploy these 8 make-believe satellites. So they went to open up the door on a Starship as it's flying from Texas and on the way to the Indian Ocean. But as it's flying, the door started to open. That's jammed, I guess. It wouldn't open. So the opening of the door was a failure. And then the 8 satellites, of course, were not able to be to launch. So that was a lost effort as well. The next thing they were supposed to do was a relight of the engine. SpaceX needs to prove that they can relight an engine on Starship. You know, there's 7 engines, but they need to relight at least one. The reason for it is once they try to put this thing into an actual orbit instead of this suborbital flights that all 9 tests have been, you know, have done. The idea is to, let me drop a step. Okay, anyway, the idea is to light an engine to prove that they could deorbit the Starship. The last thing you want to do is put this 200-foot-long thing that's, you know, almost 30 feet in diameter into orbit and then find out you can't get it out of orbit. You know, you don't want this thing in low Earth orbit causing potential problems. So what they need to do is relight an engine to deorbit it. And unfortunately, they weren't unable to even get that far to test it because they wound up with more fuel leaks. Now, they think that fuel leaks was maybe the cause last time of the Starship number 8 exploding over the Turks and Caicos Islands. So these leaks, naturally, when they're leaking, they're actually creating a reaction where the spacecraft starts spinning, and it keeps going faster and faster. And they had live video coming down. You can see this thing going out of control. So because of that, they were unable to now test their relight of the engine. So that was a failure. And another thing they wanted to test is the heat shield. They had a whole bunch of tiles that they took off because they wanted to duplicate a situation. If these tiles fell off with the new underskin that they put on, would that be good enough for, you know, stop it from burning up as it came through the atmosphere? Not because of the spinning, as this thing started to eventually come down through the atmosphere, there's no way of testing that, and that was a failure. So basically, you wound up with a complete failure for this whole flight number 9. Anyway, Brian, that's pretty much what I know about it. Not a good day for SpaceX.
Maybe they should switch flight controllers. I think there's a flight controller there that hasn't really been fully trained yet, because when I hear the recordings from SpaceX, I hear a voice go, "What's this button do?"
That's an old joke. That goes back, unfortunately, to one of the disasters with the shuttle. But what does that button do? You know, famous last words, right? Not good, Brian. What are you gonna do? Anyway. Let me go on. I'm going to talk about this moon lander.
Yeah, go ahead. You hit that one on the head. It is from that disaster. But I'm just curious. I mean, like, what does the Dragon do right that this doesn't?
Well, you know, it's so much different. You know, this is a 400 tall thing. The Falcon 9 is. You know, half that size. Falcon 9 has multiple engines. First of all, they're in the 250,000 category. The engines on Starship are twice that. You know, in a 500,000 pound category. Engine complexity, number one. Bad enough that Falcon 9 has 9. Engines on the booster and one engine on the second stage. That's complicated enough. The Raptor engines have 33 engines, and then another 7 on the second stage, which is called Starship. So you can imagine the complexity, the piping that's involved with this, and they're talking about leaks again. You know, maybe too much vibration, and, you know, that's going to add to leak, so now you need to design systems that are going to be able to handle vibrations. Who knows what it might be, but with a complex situation. They should have learned from the Russians. Let me drop it. With the N1 rocket, the Russians launched back in the 60s. They had 3 of them that actually got off the ground. They didn't get too high because they all blew up. And the reason they blew up is because it was a complex system. Now, they had 30 engines attached to each one, and they were using the N1. Long story behind the N1 engines, but when they... let me tell it anyway. After these three massive engines, three massive rockets, N1 rockets, these were going to be the moon rockets for the Russians. You know, they were, you know, 350 feet tall or whatever it was, and they were all unsuccessful. They all blew up. The N1 engines, by the way, they canceled the program. That's it. After number 3, we're not going to try anymore. Not like Elon Musk. He's already up at 9, but he's not going to give up. But the Russians gave up, and the N1 engines, they had a whole bunch more that they didn't use, so they stored them away for decades. And then as time went on, a company called Aerojet decided to buy these extra engines that were laying around in storage in Russia. Let's take them out, and we'll buy them, we'll use them for one of our rockets. So Aerojet takes them all home, and they reworked them. They tried to, you know, improve the, you know, over what they had, and they actually gave it a new name, AJ. I think they were AJ something or other, 20s or something, whatever they were, and I can look it up. AJ was for Aerojet, and they took these old N1 engines and they went, let's use them for the Antares rocket that launches out of Wallops Island. Okay, we'll do that. They launched, I think, one flight, and then they were going to launch another flight to the International Space Station. They put a Cygnus cargo vehicle on top. I think it was October 2018. And the thing got maybe about, you know, a couple thousand feet above the launch pad. And those engines failed and blew up and created a lot of damage down below. Nobody got hurt or anything, but they really damaged the launch complex in Wallops Island, Virginia. And, you know, lessons learned, they didn't use any more N1 engines. So, but you think after all these Aerojet started with Russia, maybe it's a bad idea to use, you know, countless amount of engines to try to, you know, put a rocket into space. You know, I hope it eventually all works out, but Wernher von Braun had the right idea with the Saturn V. Saturn V, they use the F1 engines for the Saturn rockets to take people to the moon. Each engine put out 1.5 million pounds of thrust, and they used five of them to get off the launch pad. You know, only five engines, fine, but each one was, you know, 1.5 million. So each one, way back then, each engine was three times more powerful than anything that Elon Musk has ever made with using the Raptor engines for the 33 engine Starship flight that keeps getting, you know, launching off the ground. So I don't know if there's an easy answer for this. I know NASA has a plan B if this doesn't work out. I hope it works out. But there is a plan B, and they're going to use Blue Origin, which is the company owned by Jeff Bezos. And right now they have a good track record. Elon has 100% failure with the nine rockets they've launched, and Blue Origin has a 100% success because they've only launched one rocket, one of their heavy lift rockets so far, and that was back in January, and they got another one coming up, I think, in late spring, maybe summer. And that one made it to orbit. So, there you go. Any comments?
Well, thank you very much for that interesting diatribe, because you've educated me a lot. And I remember when I was at the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum a few years ago, I remember standing next to a Saturn V rocket that they had on display. And I'll tell you something, you could live in that exhaust cone.
Yeah, I think yeah, you could, the diameter is probably, you know, like my height, you know, 6'2". I could probably easily fit inside that thing. And that's just one of them. And they had seven. Yeah, incredible. And that was a three-stage rocket, really. You know, that was, and they had another stage above that. And, you know, really, really amazing that, you know, what they pulled off back in the 60s. And naturally, to live through all that, you know, all this stuff gets stuck in your head. I still remember the F1 engine. All right, let me just continue on here. Let me drop it. Yeah, let's talk a minute about the new NASA administrator that we're not going to get. This fellow named Jared Isaacman. He's flown into space a couple times, not for NASA, but he flew for private missions with SpaceX. And he's a billionaire, and he paid for these flights. I don't know if he paid entirely for the other people he went up with. He's flown twice. Each time there was a crew of four. You might remember a couple years ago, Inspiration 4 was one of the missions, and during the Super Bowl, they had this big advertisement, we're going to send people on a private mission. First time, you know, if we're ever going to do this, and they named it Inspiration 4, and they got four people, one guy won some kind of a contest, another lady he picked, she knew something about engineering or something, and one of the guys that went up was Jared Isaacman, and he was the official commander of the flight, and he's a billionaire. He owns a company. I think he sold it off now, but he's still a billionaire. They called it Ship 4. I still don't know what they did, but anyway, he got rich doing whatever he did. And he paid Elon Musk a whole bunch of money to go into orbit. And one of the people that was on that flight was a lady from, young girl really, from the St. She was at one time a patient at St. Jude's. Now she's, I guess, works there, or she's involved with it now that she's older. And the deal was to raise, they plan on raising $250 million for St. Jude. I thought it was a good idea. And they got to their quota. They thought they were going to go over it. And they almost got to the quota. They got up to $200 million. And then Elon Musk, he had the rest to make up for it, for the money that they planned on raising for doing this. But then he went on another flight less than a year ago. Isaacman went on another flight, other people. And that was the flight where he wanted to be the first person to do an EVA, spacewalk. Nothing to do with NASA, so they, sure enough, they did that. They got some other woman to do it with him. They went up with, crew of four. They took turns. He went outside. And then she went outside for a while. And, they got the record for doing that. They changed the whole design of the Dragon spacecraft. The top part, which normally opens up to dock with the space station, that they changed that entirely just to make they made a cupola out of it. Just a viewing window. And, which was pretty cool. And it sure enough, that worked out. So they did that flight, and he came back, and he was also scheduled to become the first commander of the new Starship. Now, by now, the Starship should have been flying instead of, blowing these things up every other couple of months. And it should have been flying in and should have been ready for a crew, and he would have been the commander. And he had long-term plans of eventually maybe being one of the first people to orbit the moon, one of these starships and all. And then politics got in the way of this guy, and which always is a disaster, I guess, unless you know about politics. And he accepted the idea of becoming the new NASA administrator. Bill Nelson, he quit right after the election. He was with the Biden administration, so they have another lady right now in charge of NASA, which she was an engineer, mechanical engineer, good background. Anyway, she's in charge of it now, but they want to replace her with Jared Isaacman. Excuse me. Okay, everything's fine. Congress gets together. Let's interview this fellow and let's see how he does. And, he's even got some, I believe he had some bipartisan support, which is unusual in this kind of environment. So he was ready to go. In about a couple of days, they were going to vote to make this guy the new administrator. And all of a sudden, in today's news, or I think late last night, anyway, it came out where, we're going to pull this guy. That's gone. I don't know what happened. He's history. He's been scrubbed, you know, just like a rocket launch. He's been scrubbed, you know. So I'm not sure what's going to happen with the future. But I don't want to make too many predictions with NASA or anything. I can tell from 1 minute to another what's going on. Politics that does not mix with science, as far as I'm concerned, or the space program either. Just it's not a good mix. Look what happened over in Russia. You know, they kept switching their administrators left and right. This political guy, that political one guy, when we were having trouble with one of our rockets, we might not be able to get to the space station. They had this Rodigin guy from Russia in charge of their space program. Let them jump on a trampoline to get up there, you know. A bunch of wise remarks. So politics does not mix with the space program. Any comments?
I think they should really be doing is concentrate on a habitation module that will transport crew to the moon and back using centrifugal force in a cylindrical, type environment and with proper radiation shielding and get that perfected. So you'll have a source of artificial gravity when you go to the moon and eventually onto Mars. Otherwise, it's just not going to happen.
Just waiting for his phone here. There we go. You really do need artificial gravity for long-term flights. In space for 6 months, trying to get to Mars, a six-month flight. And, they can barely walk when they land here on Earth. Oh, fine, Mars is one-third our gravity, but still not easy, And there won't be anybody there to help the first crews when they go. So 6 months of weightlessness, land on Mars, try to stand up and do whatever you have to do. There's one space station that's being built, and European space agencies involved, and I believe there a company from America is involved too. Actually, the name of the company is Voyager. They've teamed together to try to build a space station, and they're going to have inside the it's pretty big in diameter. They plan actually being able to spin the inside of it. Mechanically, I don't know how they're going to be able to do this. There is a plan for that. There's thoughts and some money being put into this. NASA tried to develop it for the space station. What they call that? Was it a Nautilus? I think it was a Nautilus project where they were going to have this module mounted on the front of the International Space Station and spin it. Constantly spin. You'd be able to, go in there and have some kind of gravity. But the mechanical ability to do that, I guess, with the joint and the vibration that would cause for the space station. The space station has to be pretty solid for a lot of the experiments that they did. They nixed that program. But we'll see. I think you're right. They need to concentrate on that. They tried it in an early flight, just as an experiment, in a Gemini flight. They had the Agena spacecraft that was a target vehicle. So the Gemini went up, that's a two-man flight, two-man crew, and the idea was to attach a tether to the target vehicle, which was the Gina, and then separate. I think they were going to separate by around 100 feet, and then they were going to fire their RCS, the reaction control system, to start spinning, you know, rotating around, you know, with this thing at the other end. And it did start to work, you know, and they did get some form of gravity out of it. But after that, they pretty much gave up. That was technically very hard to do. Anyway, any comments? WS1.
Well, I think that 2001, The Space Odyssey, and the other movie, Mission to Mars, had the right idea for central gravity. For artificial gravity. And you need centrifugal force. As you're going or staying, but you need to have centrifugal force on a continual basis to mimic gravity. And you need radiation shielding to go ahead and get past, you know, the Van Allen and everything like that, and every other bit of it, of radiation that's coming from, you know, within our solar system, from especially from the sun. Once you get that under your belt, then I think that, new propulsion systems, and, you know, it's just a whole bunch of things that need to be done. But basically, you know, in my opinion, the Space Launch System, with the SLS, is just really an Apollo on steroids. It's not really any different than the Saturn V. So until you get that centrifugal gravity and radiation shielding, I don't really think you're making that much progress. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong.
SLS is a heavy lift vehicle, you know. Whatever you put up there, if you're ever going to put anything that's going to create centrifugal force, you need a heavy vehicle to do that. So, you know, one thing doesn't have to do with the other, you know. It's like, all these Starlink things they're putting up there. There's over 7,000 up there now, you know. The design of those things have nothing to do with, you know, the rocket itself. You need a big rocket to get them up there. So it's really, I know what you mean. You really need to work on both ends of it. The SLS looks like it's going to be a very reliable rocket when it does go, but you're only going to be able to launch one a year. And the only thing that's going to be reusable will be the capsule itself. And even that, they'll probably just use parts of it, you know, the spacecraft itself. But, we'll have to see. Right now, you know, government might cancel after Artemis 3. They've already said that they've canceled the Gateway project, you know. You know, they might, you know, put the stuff in mothballs and bring it back. You know, they've done that kind of thing before. I've talked about that in the past with Triana. Triana was a NOAA design. They were going to pictures of the Earth on a regular basis from 1 million miles out, always looking at the Earth 24 hours a day. But when the Bush administration got in, they canceled it. They put it into mothballs. The decades went on, and sure enough, brought it out and just, you know, fixed it up a little bit. They called it Discover. And to this day, it's operating out of that 1 million mile location called L1, Launch Point 1. I just wanted to talk about one other quick topic. The European Space Agency has a bunch of these big trance, but it's like the antennas, you know. And they plan on transmitting to deep space, the Blue Danube, you know, talking about Odyssey, you know, the theme from 2001 Space Odyssey. They actually plan on transmitting that, you know, just for the heck of it, which I thought was pretty good. They have this live orchestra that's going to play, and off the signal is going to go, and in the direction of actually one. So eventually we'll actually, you know, reach Voyager 1. Voyager 1 had a receiver on board that could listen to it. They'd hear the Blue Danube 23 hours after it started transmitting, because at the speed of light, that's how long it's going to take, 23 hours to get to pass Voyager 1. Here, Voyager 1's been launched, what, 77? Took all those years to get out that far, and this thing's going to do it in just 23 hours. It's amazing. Any comments before I close? This is WS1.
Just one thing. This is KF2CC for station ID. They need to build a habitation module, like I said, with the centrifugal force, with the radiation shielding, but I don't know what the calculations are, because the Earth is 25,000 miles in circumference, and one rotation, 24 hours, gives you the equivalent of 1G. So if you have something the size, maybe, let's go short, 50 feet from side to side, how quick do you have to revolve that? How many RPMs do you have to revolve that to give the equivalent of 1G? And that's a totally different scenario.
Yeah, I think they'd be hoping for like a third of a G. I think a third of a G, they need to be 150 feet, something like that. So to get 1G, you know, it's going to be a lot more than that. But I think they'd be happy with a third, you know, if they could get that something better than nothing. You know, give the give your muscles something to work against. You know, when Don Bennett just came back, spent 6 months in space. Don was 69, I think, when he went up. Years old when he came down, and before he went up, he had a lot of back pains and neck pains and weird things, you know, things that you get when you're older. But at 6 months in space, he said he was like a kid dropping. Besides being a fantastic photographer, I mean, this guy, this is what he does. He does photography, but he was able to do that on a regular basis. For all those months, he was a very happy guy, but physically, he was very happy. He was able to move around, and all his pains went away. He said he was like a kid again. The second he landed, floating in the water, in the SpaceX, spacecraft, waiting to be picked up, he started feeling pains in his back, all these weird things he noticed right away, and that's his biggest complaint after coming back from space. So that's if you could have one third gravity, I think the doctors think that might be good enough to ward off a lot of problems, especially for a 6 month flight to Mars. It might be just enough what they need. So figure something 100 feet, maybe or so in diameter, spinning at a certain RPM. Now, you can't spin too fast, otherwise you get what's called the Coriolis effect. You know, you find out your feet are going, for instance, if you're standing, your feet are going at a different speed than your head, and that could be a problem, you know. So that's not good either. So you can't be going too fast, but to compensate for that, you just pick a diameter to do it. Back to you, Brian, and I'm gonna sign in for that. Back to you.
K-E-2-A-J-U. Paul, this is Charlie.
Good afternoon, Charlie. How you doing? I thought you would have checked it earlier. I thought maybe you thought it was afternoon. How you doing, Charlie? Back to you. WS2S.
I'm doing great. I think this gentleman you were speaking to was pretty knowledgeable.
Yeah, I concur. And he had great questions, that's for sure. So, yeah. All right, I'm looking at the time. So, did you have something you wanted to talk about at all, Charlie? Because if not, I'm going to turn back to Roy.
No, I didn't have anything to add, but I enjoyed his conversation. I enjoyed listening to him.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. You asked great questions when you were on as well. You guys keep this portion of the net going. But for now, let me turn it back to the main portion of the net, the TechNet. This has been WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. We'll be on tomorrow night, 8:30. These repeaters will have IMARC Club Info Net followed by Swapper Shop and followed by Radio Newsline. Roy, over to you. AC2GS, WS2N, back to you.
Thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for all that you do for the SpaceNet Report, all that you do for the Technical Net, and all you do for the club. We all appreciate it, and I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. Thank you all. Please come back again. We'll be here next Sunday at 8 p.m. to do this all over again. So everyone, have a great week. Enjoy yourself. Those people doing circus, have fun. Screwing up my holidays. Anyway, everyone be safe and be well. As always, I want to remind you, Dick K2RIW used to end his technical nets with the advice to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And I'll throw back good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try to keep your mind open to new and interesting things, but don't open it wide enough that your brain falls out. Try not to read the New York Post and such for your science articles. Anyway, be well, stay safe, we'll talk again, and I'll be back next Sunday when we do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say, Slava Ukraini.
Okay, this is Brian, KF2CZ. I thank the gentleman for the very nice comments he made regarding my contribution to the SpaceNet, and I want to thank Paul and Roy for always giving their 110%, and look forward to next week. So this is KF2CZ, clear.
K-E-2-8-7-3, Brian, have a good night.
Enjoy your week. Bye.
And 73 to you also, Charlie. Have a good night.